DW Africa Link.
In today's Africa Link podcast episode, we delve into the profound implications of John Mahama's recent victory in Ghana's presidential election. As a former president reclaiming power through a democratic vote, Mahama's success reverberates across Africa, particularly for opposition parties. Now, what lessons can other African opposition movements draw from Ghana's example? And how might this reshape the political landscape across the region? Let's explore. My name is Josie Mahachi. Welcome to Africa Link, the podcast that connects you to the stories that matter from Africa.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
Once president between year 2012 and 2017, John Mahama won again Ghana's presidential election, defeating the ruling party's candidate, Vice President Mahamudu Bawumia. Mahama became the fifth opposition leader to win an election this year, following opposition victories in Botswana, Mauritius, Senegal, and the self-declared Republic of Somaliland. During the campaign, Mahama promised to transform Ghana into a 24-hour economy, a pledge that resonated with voters. In a continent where democratic transitions are increasingly tested, is Mahama's victory a sign that more opposition parties in African countries will take over? Let's discuss this with DW's Isaac Kelechi in Accra, Ghana, and Ben Graham Jones, an elections consultant. I'll start with you, Isaac. You are our DW reporter on the ground. What was your experience like covering this election?
Well, it's not different from the previous elections or since 2008 when I started covering professionally as a journalist. I think that there's been some improvement in terms of the organization, largely because, again, I'm sure the country has matured in this process. So both political parties and the Electoral Commission have all improved in terms of how to put structures in place. So, I mean, in this year's election, you had more polling stations. So obviously that helps to deal with the numbers. But most importantly also, we had some kind of low turnout. So obviously that would be the reason why we didn't have so much of the crowd. But relatively, it was smooth and peaceful. And I think that it's not so much different, but there has been some improvement in the whole coordination process. Yeah, apart from the delays by the Electoral Commission to release the results, and largely because it tried to use a regional kind of coalition, which used not to be in the past the procedure. That obviously means that there's a bit of a delay. But in all, when you ask me, I think it was a good election. Yeah.
Right. Now, Ben, you are an elections consultant, and I know you've been looking forward to this election. I remember from our last chat a few weeks ago. But were you surprised by Mahama's election victory?
I wasn't really surprised at all, no. I think that there'd been, certainly speaking to Ghanaian friends, and the issue of the economy and the economic woes that Ghana has been experiencing for some time, I think certainly has been a theme of the lead up to this election. And I think when you looked at the data, when you looked at the unemployment, you looked at Ghana having to go to the IMF, it really, I think, made for a very, very difficult situation for a party seeking re-election.
But you know that President John Mahama was there at the helm between 2012 and 2017. And one would just wonder, what is he likely to do different this time?
Well, I mean, in the back end of his previous administration, he developed a reputation for having presided over power cuts. And of course, there was a you know, he's inheriting now, I think, a challenging economic situation. You had inflation at 54% coming out of 2022. It's much lower now, but prices are still rising at a considerable rate. So he will not want to go back to some of the challenges that he faced in his first administration. But to do that, he's going to have to make the economy work for him.
Okay. Now, then I come back to you, Isaac. What stood out for you from the speech that President John Mahama made last night?
Well, he was trying to be a bit uniting in his message, because again, I mean, the election is over now, and so his tone has to change. He has to be more kind of, yeah, this is a leader for the country. It doesn't matter whether you voted for me or not. I'm here to help fix the problems you've had. But again, I was also quite instructive for him to realize that the election, the victory he had, was largely because Ghanaians were angry with the state of the economy, with the governance, the experience over the past 8 years under Akufo-Addo. And so he knows that the same fate could await his party if they mismanage. And again, of course, he has been victim already of that, because in 2016, he had that kind of verdict on him when he had a lot of issues to deal with the power prices, going to the IMF, perceptions of corruption. He was voted out massively. And I'm sure that he will learn from that. And so it was instructive in his speech for him to remind his folks that they need to be mindful, they need to manage things properly, because they could also suffer the same fate if they don't manage well. And I think, again, also for him to also make it clear to Ghanaians to know that, yeah, it's a tough job they have taken up. It's not like a honeymoon sort of. So they need to shorten their celebrations and get to work. It was also instructive for me to see that from Wednesday, which is tomorrow, they obviously are beginning to work towards transition, which means that, I mean, they want to get things going. There's nothing really to try and be slow about now. They need to get things done quickly. And I think that those were quite instructive from his speech.
Yeah, but you know, Kelechi, when you say that he's learned from his past mistakes, and then he's back again, and also he doesn't want to make the same mistakes that Nana Akufo-Addo has made as president. But I'm just wondering, there were about 12 candidates, right? Not just two candidates, 12 candidates. And it looks like with Ghana, it's always either NPP, NDC, NPP, NDC. Is it that Ghanaians don't trust or are scared of change or are scared of trying new things?
Well, it's largely political and history as well. I mean, across the world, we have countries where you have two major political parties. And even though you have other minority parties, basically they can't do much to change the fortunes, because you have people who support parties for various reasons. Is that tribal, either regional sentiments, among others. So Ghana, as we speak, we have two major political parties, and there's nothing you can do about that. So
it means that the other candidates should not even waste their time.
Well,
I was looking at that Gen Z candidate.
You see, you need to understand the history of the country and the political history to know that to be able to become president, you need to belong to these two major political parties. You won't change that anytime soon. And we've been trying to see whether there will be any new force that can change the fortunes, but it hasn't happened yet in the Fourth Republic. So that is a problem. And the issue also is that people didn't have much alternative. Is it that the NPP or the NDC? And if you're not happy with the incumbent government, you go to the opposition. Even if you are not willing to give them the chance, you have no other choice than to go there. So the history is that we have two major political parties. They are grounded, regional, tribal. And so you can't do much to move it now. It will take some time for us to have a third force, really, so that you can see, if I'm not happy with this, I move to this one. Yeah.
All right. And Ben, what do you make of this point just from Isaac Kelechi, that this is what happens in Ghana, but we saw 12 candidates. That's like 10 more candidates that were just like on the playground, but in a way, they are not part of the competition.
It's very, very difficult in electoral systems that favour the sort of all or nothing type system that Ghana has. It's very difficult for new political forces and for outside forces to break through. It's always very easy for the big parties to make the argument that a vote for the smaller party or for the newcomer is actually a vote for the other main party. So it's a classic problem. There are examples and recent examples of a third party or sort of outsiders breaking through. We saw that, for example, in Senegal. But in the type of system that Ghana has, it makes it the odds are stacked against that type of political change.
Mm-hmm. And now Mahama ran and won as the main opposition candidate. What does his victory mean for opposition parties in other African countries that will have elections in 2025, Ben?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, Josie, because there's been a lot of talk this year about how it's been a bad year for incumbents and a sort of a great year for peaceful democratic transitions in Africa. I think, though, some of that talk may have been a little bit overstated. If we have a look, there's been five incumbents who've been deposed in Africa this year. To my knowledge, that's been in Mauritius, Somaliland, Ghana, Senegal, and Botswana. But actually, I think when you look at some of those countries, these are some of the most institutionalized democracies on the continent. Mauritius, Somaliland, Botswana, and Ghana. A number of those, really, I don't think anybody was surprised that the nature of the transition has been relatively peaceful. So 2025, I think, is the real test where you actually have some... you have some really significant elections that are going to be coming up where it's really unclear which way they are going to go and the degree to which state resources may or may not be leveraged in support of incumbent candidates. We've got big contests coming up in Tanzania, for example. In Ivory Coast, there's going to be an enormous election between the two big men of Ivorian politics, Alassane Ouattara and Laurent Gbagbo. In Cameroon, there's going to be a major contest to see whether Paul Biya can be displaced, the longest-serving president on the continent. And we'll see in Gabon also whether the military transition leads to credible elections. So I think that some of the talk about the successes of this year has been a little bit overstated, and it will be interesting to have this conversation a little bit further down the line.
Mm-hmm. And to you also, Isaac, you've been covering elections, not just in Ghana, but also in some parts of Africa. And I'm just thinking, what do you think Mahama's victory means for opposition parties in other African countries, potentially across West Africa?
It depends on the kind of opposition party you're talking about. If it's a very major political party which is in opposition, obviously it gives them that kind of, an encouragement to know that, if they work hard and they saw their messages, obviously, they will definitely get the victory. For example, in Ghana, people were making news about Trump winning, which is the second coming of Trump, obviously. So Mahama, obviously, a second coming of Mahama could work. And so these trends obviously just excite political parties. But I think besides that, you need to work hard domestically to sell your message. You need to be grounded to make sure that you win. It's not because Mahama wins. So obviously means that if you're also in opposition, you win. But obviously the dynamics will change. But I just think that it gives them encouragement, a signal that, if you're in opposition, if you work hard, and if you're in government and you mismanage, you can easily be kicked out. And I think that across Africa, electorate are beginning to be more wiser now. They are beginning to believe that they can take bold decisions and they can vote out leaders. Even if not, they can chase them out. If not, they can hold, for example, protests like we've seen in Kenya to turn the hands of political leaders. So I think that this trend obviously tells us that in 2025, we could still see a lot of change in governments.
Right. And Ben, what message then should the opposition parties focus on for them to stand a chance of defeating incumbents?
Well, fundamentally, what the data shows is that the way that you motivate behavior change is by speaking to people's hearts. Now there's been global economic headwinds this year, which have often favored opposition parties. Many countries around the world have struggled with the global economic situation. But if that subsides, if the global economic data improves heading into next year, opposition parties are going to need to make you're going to need to have different strategies to try to persuade the electorates and really have to try to understand how to make that perhaps a motive case for why their ideas are the best to their electorate.
And Kelechi, just to also find out with the youth, I know you say that the numbers were not as much as the previous election, but how active was the youth vote in this election? Did their involvement in a way influence the outcome?
Yes, largely, especially in the electoral process. I mean, you're having young people who really are not so much into lineage to political parties or tribal sentiments because they're young. I mean, some of them were born in the Fourth Republic. They're very young. So they only deal with what they're experiencing now. And for many of the parties, the young people drove the campaigning processes in terms of where they go, the messages on social media and all that. So they played a key role indeed in the campaigning process. In voting, yes, we saw a lot of young people come out to vote. And if you see the reactions on social media, it tells you a lot of young people really were able to bring about some kind of change. And for example, Monday evening at Mohammed's official, at Mohammed's office premises, you could see many young people were there within the party. So obviously it tells you that we are beginning to have a youthful population taking over these political parties. And they play a key role if you can win their hearts with the messages, especially, for example, issues of job creation, it wins their hearts. Or if it's even digitalization, it wins their hearts. So they played a key role in the election.
Right. And you are also a young Ghanaian. I know you're a journalist, but you're also like you experience this and you are deep in whatever happens in the country. What are the immediate next steps do you expect to see from Mahama's government?
I mean, he first needs to immediately begin to show signals that he wants to really create a job that he wants to create for the young people. He speaks about 24-hour economy. He needs to be able to let this begin to see it come to fruition. Let's see some kind of policy in place to show that indeed the young people are going to get the jobs that he promised through this policy. But most importantly, also, he needed to be bold in fixing the issues of corruption, because again, that has made a lot of young people unhappy, looting of property or corruption in various places. And he needs to show boldly that he wants to retrieve all those things, because then it gives confidence to the young people that indeed he is serious about what he had promised on the campaign period.
And was the issue of gender balance also mentioned in his when it comes to his cabinet?
Yeah, that has been one thing he was championing in his first cabinet. In fact, what even makes it even quite interesting is because he has a vice president who is a female. So obviously, he must vote on that we should see.
And that's the first for Ghana, right?
Yeah, that's the first for Ghana. So you must see more of that in his appointments and all the other appointments, apart from ministerial appointments. We must see that in there. And I think he has a lot of female elements around his camp. So obviously, we should have more of them in his government. And that should show a signal that, Ghana wants to get to at least 30-35% of women in political leadership. And he should be able to show to do that.
Mm-hmm. And Ben, just come to you now. We're trying to figure out how other African countries can learn even from what happened in Ghana. And to talk about the election monitoring, what role really do election observers, both local and international, play during this process?
So election observers really have two main roles, and one is to be really give that assessment, that impartial assessment on the basis of the laws of the country, but also those international standards that the country has signed up to. And on that basis, come out with the conclusions about the degree of fit between that process in the country and those standards that have been signed up to. And the second role really is sort of preventive. The idea is that by having observers on the ground, in this case from organizations like the Commonwealth, from YAGA Africa, from within the region and local Ghanaian organizations, the idea is having those eyes disincentivizes foul play, because people know that if they engage in it, then the observers will should at least call that out. So those are the sort of purposes of observers. And I think it was really encouraging that Ghana made the effort to extend those invitations. That's not always the case. Countries don't always invite and allow for the operation of election observers. That's a really important step for securing the transparency of an election process.
And speaking of transparency, how does Ghana's electoral system contribute to this and the fairness of its elections? Are there lessons for other African nations there?
So I was looking actually at the address of Samson, the executive director of Yaga Africa, the other day. Sort of a Nigeria-based organization who sends like a study mission through to Ghana. And he made some really interesting points about the lessons for other African countries. He really focused on this issue of transparency. And he noted that actually the agents of the party get to see and get to are asked to sort of sign off that process at every level so they can compare the results that they've got from their representatives through the parallel vote tabulation. So the results they're getting from all of their representatives across the country with the official results. So it allows parties to verify and see that the process itself is in conformity with the data that they have. Another thing which I found really interesting from Yaga Africa's conclusions was this idea that every party has is given the opportunity to put their seal on the ballot box, whereas in most countries there's just one seal from the official election commission. And so the idea is that generates an extra layer of accountability. And the third point you made was about the strength of Ghanaian institutions. And really, I think when we saw that some of the statements that came out facilitating this peaceful transition, I think that was just so incredibly positive and speaks to that very positive institutional culture in Ghana. But as I say, it's sort of expected, I think, at this point that this type of transition, this type of peaceful democratic process comes out of Ghana, a country that's been through this a number of times. And the bigger question, I think, as we look forward to the wider region next year, is whether other countries will be inspired by the stories coming out of Ghana and elsewhere, and whether we'll see that wider democratic transformation.
Right, right. Now, Ben, we can't conclude without me asking this question. Do you see a situation where the opposition could, for example, defeat presidents like Uganda's Yoweri Museveni or Cameroon's Paul Biya?
These, of course, are very different situations than in Ghana, where often in countries like Cameroon and in Uganda, the instrument of state is used heavily to try to suppress the likelihood that opposition parties will have a first shot at government. So quite often it's not just about, of course, who do people support and who do they vote for, but who counts the votes can matter just as much. So that's of course a real concern. But of course, some of those leaders who've been in power for a very, very long time are themselves now in the 70s. I think Paul Biya is even in his 90s. So we will definitely see some sort of development in a number of those countries over the coming years.
Okay, thank you so much. DW's Isaac Kelechi in Accra, Ghana, and Ben Graham-Jones, an elections consultant. Many thanks for joining us.
Africa is changing. Don't get left behind. Tune in to Africa Link.
At the Africa Link podcast, we always look across the continent to see how the stories and issues we are dealing with play out or at times even overlap. Next year, 2025, a total of 12 African countries will conduct presidential and parliamentary elections. These elections have the potential to significantly shape the future of the continent. Amongst them is Cameroon, which has been led by Paul Biya, one of Africa's longest-serving heads of state. If he runs again, Biya will be 92 years old. So what chances does the opposition in Cameroon have in ending Biya's more than four decades rule? Let's hear what some Cameroonians have to say.
I am Abanda Edwin. I'm a pastor. I'm a little bit skeptical when it comes to the opposition performing a magical one this time, given that the opposition has been very comatose in their activities. They have not been vocal. They have refused to coalesce together. How do you expect a country that is having close to 400 parties and there is only a strong ruling party that is having grip over the national territory, and you think that the opposition can do anything? I think that from their inability to actually communicate adequately to Cameroonians and sock deep into divisions, subdivisions and villages, and being a national party, the ruling party has rather played a fast one by creating this numerous group, which some of them have decided to rather join the ruling party and weaken the opposition. So I do not expect anything magical this time.
My name is Dzingana Raymond. I'm a farmer in Cameroon. The chances are very slim. Very slim because we have an opposition that does not communicate. We have areas that they would have actually capitalized on and actually win the minds, the hearts and minds of the population. But they don't communicate. And if you ask me, I'll say that it is because they don't have anything to offer. Because I think in the CEMAC zone, Cameroon has the weakest opposition, an opposition that is not serious. It is like they don't even know what they want. So their chances are very slim. One, it is difficult to actually know what these opposition parties really want. So even to come together and form a coalition, everybody wants to be at the top. Greed, all these things, it has weakened the opposition in Cameroon. And as far as I'm concerned, going to the 2025 presidential elections would just be a waste of time because their chances are very slim.
Those were some Cameroonians expressing their views on whether the opposition parties in Cameroon stand a chance against the current president, Paul Biya. That's it for this edition of Africa Link. Remember, you are not just a listener, but a part of our community, and your engagement can shape the direction of our discussions. We value your insights and encourage you to share your thoughts with us. Remember to click follow so you can catch all of the Africa Link podcast episodes. This podcast was co-produced and edited by Isaac Mugabe. My name is Josie Mahachi. Thanks for listening. Until the next one, it's bye for now.
DW News.
Good day, I'm Sirtan Sanderson with the news on Africa Link. Well over 100 people have been killed in Sudan as the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces traded barrel bombs and shelling across the country. The majority of the victims are believed to be civilians. In the city of Omdurman, paramilitary shelling on Tuesday was said to have killed at least 65 people, according to the state's governor. Meanwhile, the governor of the capital, Khartoum, said a single shell fired by the RSF struck a passenger bus and killed all 22 people on board. The attack came a day after an army airstrike on a market in the North Darfur town of Kapkabiya, which reportedly killed over 100 people. Zambia's constitutional court has barred former President Edgar Lungu from contesting in the 2026 presidential election because it confirmed that he had already served the two maximum terms allowed. Lungu had argued that he should be allowed to run again as he did not serve a full five-year term during his first term. Lungu was first elected president in January 2015 to serve the remaining 20 months of his predecessor's term, following the death in office of President Michael Sata in October 2014. France has officially initiated the withdrawal of its troops from Chad following the termination of its defense cooperation agreement. The move comes just 2 weeks after Chad's decision to end the deal on November 28th. The withdrawal began with the departure of two French warplanes which had been stationed in the capital, N'Djamena. The troop withdrawal signifies the end of decades of French military dominance in the Sahel region, following also the departure of French troops from Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger due to military coups in those countries. You're listening to Africa Link News. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz is due to present the formal application for a vote of no confidence in his government. This is the first step to snap elections, which will be scheduled in February. Germany's lower house of parliament, the Bundestag, will vote on the motion on December 16th. The parliamentary vote is largely considered to be a formality, as opposition lawmakers outnumber those in Scholz's minority government and are in support of fresh elections. Taiwan's military says that 53 Chinese aircraft and 19 vessels were detected near the island nation as Beijing has started conducting its largest maritime exercises in decades. Taiwan's defense ministry stressed that China had deployed its largest naval fleet in regional waters since 1996. The deployment is bigger than the most recent major military drills of 2022. This latest spike in tensions comes after Taiwanese President Lai Ching-te visited the country's closest ally, the United States, last week. And that's all the news we have for today. Thank you for joining me, as well as my team. I'm Sir Thomas Anderson.
DW. Made for Minds.